Hello and welcome to Volume 7 of Capital Ideas Live. In this issue, we'll make you aware of the status of reforms in the death tax. We'll discuss some forestry courses that are available to the public to help you be a better forest manager. We'll also highlight some books, research, and software applications of particular use to forest owners. And before we're through, we'll discuss the stumpage market and feature some timberland for sale. I'm Hayes Brown, the General Counsel for the Alabama Forest Owners Association, and I'll be your host for today's discussion. Well, to begin, let's discuss the death tax. In order to do so, we're joined by Frank Stewart. Hello, Frank.
How you doing?
Fine. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You're the Executive Director of the Forest Landowners Tax Council. Now, Warren Buffett and Bill Gates Sr. and some others say that we should keep the death tax. What's really at stake here for the forest landowner?
Well, every year the death tax forces timberland owners to interrupt their management plans to sell timber or even their land. Some say even that there's been so much talk from the people that you just mentioned, Bill Gates Sr. And others like the Rockefellers, that President Bush may be considering leaving the death tax out of his tax initiative. But we know that those folks have been on a media tour, and they've been around asking folks to keep the death tax. They don't want they want to prevent the death tax from building wealth. And you're right, the cow's out of the barn on their wealth building, on their own wealth building. So their arguments are disingenuous, since even after death tax, their inheritors will remain fabulously wealthy. We need to stand up for the death tax repeal and tell the real story.
Well, I was recalling last year there was a gradual elimination of the death tax that I believe passed both houses of Congress, but it was vetoed by President Clinton. Is there any movement now to reintroduce the bill this year?
Absolutely, both on the Senate and the House sides. On the Senate side, Senator Kyle has a bill that would, as we understand it now, neither one of those the Senate or House bills have been introduced, so we don't know the exact language, but we understand Senator Kyle and Bro, who is co-sponsoring with him, have a bill that would immediately eliminate the death tax, but it doesn't allow for step-up in cost basis, or at least it allows for a certain amount at the low end. Representative Jennifer Dunn's bill, on the other hand, is similar to the previous bill, H.R. 8, which passed last year, which allows a elimination of the death tax over 10 years and allows for a step-up in cost basis.
Okay, so those bills originating in the House of Representatives then?
One in the Senate, one in the House, yes.
Okay. Now, well, as landowners and taxpayers, what do you think would be the most effective way to make this issue known to your representative?
I think a letter to our congressional delegations, senators and representatives, is appropriate at this time, and that we write also President Bush to ask him to stay on track and to ask for his continued support for the death tax repeal.
Mm-hmm.
The only way to fix the death tax is to eliminate it.
The best way to fix it is to eliminate it, right. Well, the current administration had the elimination of the death tax as one of their key points in a campaign. Do you see some friendliness in that area?
We see that, and we think that continues. But their strategy at the moment is continued with the to include the death tax provisions in the Bush tax initiative. But there may be some pressure being applied to separate the two.
Mm-hmm.
And whichever way we go, we'd like to see it done this year.
Okay, thank you, Frank. We appreciate your perspective.
Thank you for asking me.
Our next guest is William Esche. Welcome, Dr. Esche.
Well, thank you, Hayes, for having me on your program this morning.
I look
forward to talking with you about adverse possession and trespass.
Well, good. You're a professor at Mississippi State, and that's what I wanted to talk with you about. I think you're offering a class in the continuing
education. Yes, we're offering a a class from March the 27th through the 28th of this year here on the campus of Mississippi State University, sponsored by the College of Forest Resources at Mississippi State. It's a 10-hour course, 5 hours on adverse possession law, and then another 5 hours on trespass. This course is particularly geared for those landowners, either urban land, but primarily rural or timber landowners, who have had problems in either one of these legal areas or may in the future encounter these problems. If you haven't had problems in these areas before, this course will acquaint the landowner on how to deal with these problems and how to avoid them in the future.
Well, how then would a landowner know if he had an adverse possession issue that he needed to address?
Well, the law of every state requires some notice, a visual notice that would put the record title holder on notice and that his or her land was being adversely possessed. This visual notice could be, for example, a fence, a new fence running across your property. It could be somebody that begins to row crop on your property, or someone who even cuts timber on your property and begins to manage this timber that is really yours as theirs. So there has to be some type of visual notice requirement under the statute before the record title holder would be put on notice that his land was being adversely possessed.
And then once that happens, a clock starts, doesn't it?
The clock starts, and in Mississippi it's 10 years. The landowner has 10 years to oust the adverse possessor from his property or to sue him in a court of law or equity to evict them from the property.
So it sounds like being inactive while that is going on your land is a dangerous thing to do.
Well, it is. It's particularly dangerous for absentee landowners who do not keep up with their boundary lines. Also, a particular problem area deals with these larger paper companies who have foresters come in and out, move in and out pretty rapidly, and who become familiar with the landlines, and then they move out and another forester comes in. Well, this allows adverse possessors an excellent opportunity to ease over on their property. We'll also be talking about the legal concept of the round 40. During this adverse possession presentation. Every landowner who owns rural or timberland should know what a round 40 is.
And that's something they would be able to find out at that course. All right?
Yes.
Well, what does the trespass portion of the course cover then?
Yes, the trespass portion of the course will cover questions as: what is timber trespass? Who is liable for timber trespass on my property? What is my liability as a consultant? What must I prove in order to recover damages to my timber as a result of timber trespass? And lastly, what preventative measures can I take to avoid timber trespass on my land?
Okay, and all that occurs on the second day, I assume.
Yes. Well, actually, it's Dr. Alan Barnes and I are conducting this course, and it will begin in the afternoon of one day and be completed the morning of the next day. And instead of us each going straight 5 hours, we will really be dividing it up and giving the participants a little mixture of both so they won't get burned out, and neither will we. 5 hours is a long time to talk.
All right. Now, this is something that anyone can attend, you mentioned, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Anybody can attend it. It's just a matter of contacting the continuing forestry education coordinator, Alan Brown. in the College of Forest Resources here at Mississippi State.
All right, I believe we have a link to that. Well, I thank you, Dr. Esche, for participating. This class, again, is on March 27th through 28th in Starkville, Mississippi. We appreciate you joining us today.
Well, thank you for inviting me, and we look forward to seeing you at Mississippi State.
Bob Jaden is with us. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
You're an extension specialist at the Y Education Center in Maryland. And like Dr. Esche, you have a course that's offered to the public. Can you tell us about it?
Yes, we're really excited about it up here. We, as most extension organizations, have had forestry seminars and programs for landowners. And we found that many of the landowners want more than the seminar, but can't afford to go to college to get a credit. So what we, regular college credit. So what we decided to do was develop a traditional correspondence course. And landowners can take this course at the leisure of their home. And we pretty much offer it twice a year and offer it, about a four-month period of time, very similar to a college course where you have 4 months to complete it.
All right. What topics are you going to cover in the course then?
Oh, it's skimming the top of all forestry. It truly is a general forestry correspondence course where you learn some general forest history, some basic concepts of forest management and silviculture. You really learn how to conduct a forest inventory. The folks are really, they're going to go out and take some measurements in the forest that ultimately will lead to developing a framework for a forest management plan. And they're also going to become familiar with how to make informed decisions on timber sales and understanding the forest industry.
What kind of prior experience in forestry would you have to benefit from the course?
The course is designed for with minimal amount of knowledge of forestry. We find that, particularly in our state here, that there are very few landowners that are touched by any type of formal forestry education, and some of the landowners have minimal knowledge of that forest management. So I think this course will be good for people who both have a rather extensive knowledge of forestry, but those who have limited knowledge.
Mm-hmm. And you wouldn't even really have to own a forest at all if you had access to one, I suppose.
That's correct. The main thing that we do ask the student to do is they have to go out and take measurements and make observations in the forest. And the pretty much the finale or the final of the course, so to speak, would be develop a framework for a forest management plan on a piece of property, whether it's their own or a piece of state property or industry property. It's to really get them to appreciate what goes into developing a forest management plan.
Okay. And what does a forest management plan cover? What exercise would that create?
What our purpose is to, particularly for the private landowner, is to get them stimulated to really, truly do some type of forest management activity. This framework for a plan, they'll have some of the basic things like soil information and what the inventory is and the status of the trees on the particular property and what's needed, what their objectives are. And then in turn, they can go to a forester to develop that plan further.
Okay. Now, the next period of time that it's offered would be when?
The next time would be September.
Okay, in September.
Yes.
Great. Thanks, Bob. Appreciate you joining us.
Okay.
Joining us next is a frequent contributor to the discussion on growing longleaf. AFOA welcomes Mark Haynes.
Thanks, Sam.
You're an alumni to Capital Ideas Live. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Mark, you're with the Longleaf Alliance, and I understand you've got two studies going on right now. One of them deals with site preparation for longleaf, and the other one deals with planting depth for longleaf. Tell us about the first one, this site preparation for longleaf study that you're doing.
Sure. We've been seeing quite a few planting failures the last couple of years, primarily through plantings in the Conservation Reserve Program on old fields and pastures. And we've learned through hard experience that if you want to be successful with longleaf, you need to have the right site preparation, and you need to plant good quality seedlings early in the planting season. You need to plant them at the correct depth, and you need to follow up with the right herbaceous release. To determine what is the best site preparation method in herbaceous release, we set up this study in an old pecan orchard where we had some of our most problematical old field weeds, such as Bermuda grass, bahia grass, crabgrass, etc. We looked at three different site preps, a broadcast chemical with a Roundup arsenal. We looked at a scalping site prep, and this is where we peel back the sod and expose the bare mineral soil to a depth of 3 or 4 inches and a width of 2 to 3 feet. and then we looked at a check or no site prep. And we followed all of these site preparations up with 11 different herbaceous releases the spring after planting. Our year one differences were very significant. On following scalping, we had 87% survival of our longleaf pine seedlings versus 72% with the chemical site prep and 64% with the no site prep. The differences are really widening out now at year two. We have 82% survival following a scalping site prep versus 60% with a chemical and 46% with no site prep. And we've also found some very effective herbaceous releases. For instance, if we scalped before we planted and then released the following spring with Belpar oust, then we're averaging 91% survival at age two with 80% starting height growth. So we're seeing both very good responses in terms of survival and growth from the scalping site prep. And we think we've got some excellent combinations for landowners who are interested in establishing longleaf in these old fields and pastures.
Okay, so the focus of the study then is how to keep your longleaf seedlings surviving into the next year, right?
That is correct.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, tell us then about the second study on planting depth.
Another important factor that has gotten a lot of people into trouble in planting longleaf pine is planting their seedlings at the wrong depth. And conventional wisdom said that if you plant them just a little bit too deep or a little too shallow, then you were going to have poor survival. So we installed a study a couple years ago looking at different planting depths, and we did find that if you plant them a little too deep where the terminal bud is covered, it has severe impacts on both survival and growth. On the other hand, we planted some very shallow, and for instance, with the plug about a half inch above the soil surface, and we're finding that these seedlings are still surviving and growing pretty well. So if you're going to err when planting longleaf, we advise that you err on the side of planting too shallow, because you still could end up with a surviving seedling that is growing well. But if you plant them just a little bit too deep, they're pretty well history.
Okay. Well, we have some pictures, I think, beside your image there on the website, and we'd caution that the pictures do load kind of slow, so do take a look at it and take a few minutes to let those pictures download. Thank you, Mark, for joining us.
Thank you.
Dr. Jim Miller is our next guest. He's with the U.S. Forest Service. Good morning, Jim.
Hi, Hayes and AFOA members everywhere.
Great. Well, you and Carl Miller have a new book coming out, don't you?
Well, actually, Hayes, it's already out and available, and we're trying to get attention to it for those that we think will have value in it, and that's a lot of folks. We have a field manual that 454 pages that describes 330 species of forbs, grasses, shrubs, woody vines, and ferns. Everything but the trees out there. You have to get another tree book. And in this, we have 644 color photographs of these plants and their identifying features.
Now, this book's called Forest Plants of the Southeast and Their Wildlife Uses.
That's right.
So we're not really talking about the merchantable species here. We're talking about these 330 species of non-merchantable plants.
That's right. Probably non-merchantable. Now, we have saw palmetto coming on now, Hayes, you know, that has some merchantability, and it's in there, but also we have the, besides all these plants that we see every day in our forest and provide everything out there for the wildlife, we have descriptions of their wildlife uses. Carl Miller is a noted wildlife from the University of Georgia, and he's the one that prepared those sections.
All
also
right.
We have those non-native exotic invasive species included, so that you can identify those plants that may have present a real threat to your ownership and future productivity.
Who would be the audience for this type of publication?
Well, we've written it for a wide audience, and certainly for the forest landowner and the forest manager. We've tried to make it in simple terms, but still it's a scientific basis. But I think the descriptions can be read by everyone and understood, as well as the high-quality photographs we have on facing pages. So you have the description on one side and the pages on the other, and there's a example on your all's website that lets the user see that.
Right. No, well, that's very helpful to have that visual image there. Now, It sounds like it would benefit a person who's interested in enhancing wildlife habitat particularly.
Oh, certainly would. I think it will, with the other great volumes that are coming out nowadays on wildlife management, this is one that can be added to that. Also, wildflower enthusiasts, teachers, and students, it's something you can carry around and look at your leisure and I think enjoy.
All right. How much?
Well, we tried to keep the price real low. It's a nonprofit organization that did this. It was $36. That includes shipping and handling. And that's with the Southern Weed Science Society is the publishers. And it's listed on your website how to get that. And so the order form and who to send it to is there. I don't know if you want me to give the address now, but it's there.
I think we can link to that, and that sounds like it's well worth it. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Miller.
My pleasure.
Well, it's a long way from the Tennessee Valley to Silicon Valley, but the Forest Research Systems Institute is helping us bridge that gap. FORS has been a leader in providing useful software applications for forest owners, and we're joined by Steve Nodine, who's FORS president. Thank you for joining us, Steve.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here today.
Well, what's new in the area of software applications?
Well, you know, Hayes, there's a lot of applications that we think about for computers that they've really become a standard tool for folks who own or manage forest land. And even though a lot of programs are designed to be used by professional foresters with technical backgrounds, there are quite a few that can be used by landowners as well to help them work more closely with their forestry advisors, consulting foresters, and others. There's four main areas that there are some activities going on that landowners can take advantage of. Area of forest finance, where there's some new package that helps forest landowners determine the value of their land, the profitability, help make some decisions and so forth. In the area of mapping, there are some new GPS units or systems that are available that a lot of folks have a lot of interest in, sometimes have some confusing questions that come up, and we always are glad to help folks with those. And there's some mapping programs even that forest landowners can use themselves if they're into their forest management activities to that degree. And they're easy to use. They don't require a lot of technical background. There are some distance measuring devices that work well in the field to help measure distances and some new computerized calipers that are helping to measure trees. And a lot of landowners don't get it too much into the timber cruises, but they would like to be able to get better accuracy in the measurements they take. And then there's also some activities in terms of just being able to get more discussion going on. And we've created a new website or a new section of our website for forest landowners about the types of computer programs that are available. We've got highlighted that special forest finance pack for landowners that I mentioned that includes some software, tutorials, special templates, and so forth that can be very helpful. So there's, and we've also got a section there where they can pose questions to us or to an email list and get some responses back, and also offer suggestions as to what types of software or computer technology they feel like would be helpful to them.
All right. Well, you can help a landowner then advise them on what would be a particularly useful application for them and help them learn how to use it, I suppose.
That's right. We work with forest landowners and professional foresters every day, helping them to find what might be available to help answer questions about how to use it. We provide technical support. We're a not-for-profit organization, so we don't have the constraints that some companies would of supporting one product or another. So we help people find what will suit them the best. And we teach workshops as well, so folks can find out the calendar of events from our website to see what may be coming up in that regard.
Okay. Well, thank you for joining us, Steve.
Thank you very much.
Many of the high-quality forestry publications that you've been seeing are the product of Rob Mara and his leadership. He's with Resource Management Services, a forestry consulting firm. Hello, Rob.
Good morning.
Well, it's part of your job to keep up also with the stumpage market. And, boy, last year we experienced a downturn in certain parts of the stumpage market. Tell
right.
us what happened last year.
Well, it's really a pleasure being with you guys this morning. And I know one of the things that's really been on a lot of people's minds right now is the markets. And like I was telling somebody the other day, I guess the bubble's kind of popped. And I know in the economy, we've definitely enjoyed about 15 months of economic growth, and it looks like we're going to be in a little bit of a downturn here. But one of the things that we look at is that, you know, the beauty of timber as an investment, it kind of grows on the stump as long as it's there. So that's one good thing about stumpage and the timber that we're able to manage and a lot of people own. Let me just give you a little bit of background of what's going on in the economy and maybe kind of give you a little bit of background on what's causing a lot of this downturn in the market that we're seeing. Really, the U.S. and Japan are really the two largest consumer of forest products in the world, and they drive the global demand for forest products around the world. And really, the recent downturn in U.S. timber markets is cyclical and due to some temporary oversupply as a result of a couple of factors that we've been watching. Number one, a strong dollar, which makes imported wood cheaper and harder for the U.S. to sell its timber in international markets. I talked to a sawmill owner the other day that said only about 3% of his timber was going overseas today because of the strong dollar. And this is pretty much true across the board, but especially for Canada, where the government heavily subsidizes the industry. And secondly, Japan's economic woes and their slowdown have backed up wood in the Pacific Northwest and Canada, which in turn backs up wood in the South, and because about 50% of Canadian lumber production is exported to the U.S. So you can kind of compare this to like the old soap opera, you know, as the world turns, it's almost as the wood flows. And thirdly, we really look at the U.S. mills, and what they've done over the last couple of years have increased their efficiency by about 30% in the last 5 to 6 years, which really temporarily increases capacity. And the industry has also undergone a lot of restructuring to reduce operating costs, you know, with quite a few mills shutting down across the South. And these adjustments should have been made about five years ago, but, you know, they've pretty much disrupted wood flows as many local events, such as a lot of the CRP plantations coming on, and then we've had about a year and a half of dry weather or drought.
Mm-hmm.
And we really see over the next 3 years, we see no new capacity coming online for pulp and paper products in the South. But there continues to be a good fundamental balance between supply and demand for timber in the South. And I tell people all the time, if I was going to be a timberland owner, that, you know, the South is the wood basket of the U.S., and it's a great place to own timberland. And that's why we know the markets here, we feel like, are going to rebound over the next 1 to 3 years. And much kind of the bottom line, what we tell a lot of our clients is not to sell a lot of their timber unless they need some income until some of these markets come back up, maybe towards the latter part of this year into next year.
Okay. So it sounds like on the future, the financial growth might not be very imminent, but biological growth is still there.
That's right.
Okay.
They're still growing before you cut them.
All right. Thank you, Rob. We appreciate you joining us.
Thank you.
Our final guest is Fletcher Majors with Great Southern Land Company. Hello, Fletcher.
Hello. How are you doing, Hayes? Nice to be on this conference call.
I'm fine. You've got some timberland for sale. Why don't you tell us about it?
Yes, we do. In fact, we're featuring a tract that I wanted to discuss on this conference call on Sawatchie Creek in eastern Alabama between Auburn and Montgomery. This particular tract is a tract of approximately 135 acres offered for $250,000.
All right. Now, what county would that be?
That is in Tallapoosa County.
Tallapoosa County.
And it actually fronts on a big creek, Sawatchie Creek.
All right. I suppose, does it have access to the track?
Yes, it does. In fact, one of the services we offer is when an owner lists with us, we give them advice about things they need to do. This property did not have deeded access, and we have worked with the owner in acquiring deeded access to the property.
Okay. What about the timber? Is there timber on it?
It's a good deal of timber. It has not had a recent cruise, but it's a good deal of merchantable timber on the track. The track actually belongs to two partners who are timber dealers.
Okay. Well, I think we've got some pictures of the photo next to your image on the website, and we appreciate you offering that. Fletcher?
Well, thank you.
All right. Well, the Alabama legislature reconvened a few days ago, and there's some topics that we want to make you aware of. There first appears to be a move afoot to promote countywide zoning, and this could affect forest land as local regulation becomes a prominent part of the landscape. Also, for many years, this issue of illegal dumping has been the focus of some attention. You could expect a bill to be introduced to deal with that issue. And finally, constitutional reform is on the lips of many people who would like to revise the Alabama state constitution. Now, remember that the current property tax structure is tied to the current constitution, so this can conceivably affect forest landowners. So keep a watch out for these issues. And when you do, remind your elected representative that the common wisdom that's resident in forest owners who own and actively manage their land is an irreplaceable social resource. And if you remove these people, timber owners, from the landscape, you'll remove a leavening portion of the population that should be present. Forest landowners produce natural resources, clean water, and families, passing a legacy of land ownership down to future generations. And that's all the time that we have for this issue of Capital Ideas Live. Our thanks go to Dr. William Esche, to Frank Stewart, and Bob Jaden. Thanks also to Mark Haynes, Dr. Jim Miller, and Dr. Steve Nodine. Rob Morrow and Fletcher Majors complete our panel. And on behalf of the Alabama Forest Owners Association, I'm Hayes Brown. Thanks for joining us.